You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. 10 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Wednesday, February the 21st. If you're a woman and not worried about having a heart attack or a stroke, please listen up. And guys, this won't kill you either. In fact, new guidelines issued Monday by the American Heart Association are meant to save lives. And we will talk about those new guidelines, stating that nearly all American women are in danger of heart disease or stroke and should be more aggressive about lowering their risk, including asking their doctors about daily aspirin use. We'll discuss these new guidelines and what we can do to lower our risk of heart attack and strokes. We'll talk some about the differences between men and women when it comes to heart disease. We just heard a story about a 39-year-old woman in state news who suffered two heart attacks. And we will welcome your questions and comments for our guest physician. 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890, 263-1890. We welcome your questions about how to maintain a healthy heart. Let me welcome our guest, and we are very happy to have her with us. Dr. Nancy Schweitzer is an assistant professor of medicine at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She is director of the Heart Failure Program at the University of Wisconsin Hospital and Clinics in Madison. Good morning.
Hi, Joy.
Thanks a lot for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
So this is the new part, or maybe the controversial part, with these new guidelines that women should start taking aspirin, ask their doctors about taking daily aspirins.
Yes, that's a very new recommendation. Previously, the data for aspirin use in women haven't been very conclusive, and so there has not been a strong recommendation made regarding aspirin use in men. Or women, rather. Men have been advised to take aspirin over age 45 for prevention of heart attacks for some time now at their doctor's recommendation. Several studies have come out in the last year suggesting that there's a significant reduction, particularly in stroke, for women who take aspirin, particularly older women taking aspirin over age 65. And so it is now advised that women discuss their risks and benefits with aspirin use with their doctors and determine whether that's a right treatment for them.
You do not want women to just start taking aspirin.
Correct. No woman should go out and buy aspirin and just start taking it, but it's worth having a conversation with your doctor about your risk for heart attack and stroke and whether that would outweigh the known risks of aspirin. Aspirin clearly causes an increase in bleeding, particularly bleeding in the stomach. And so in every individual, it's a matter of weighing the potential benefits of that drug against the risks of it.
Yeah, let's talk about the other guidelines. Anything different here?
Well, I think the really stunning thing about this new set of guidelines is the emphasis on how to assess risk in women. Mm-hmm. And previously, I think, and I think the reason the guidelines are written this way is that there hasn't been much attention paid to assessing risk for heart disease in women. Heart disease is the number one killer of women and kills more women every year than men. And not only do most people not know that, most physicians don't actually know that.
It kills more women than men.
Every year.
That I didn't know, yeah.
Yeah, most people don't know it, and most doctors don't know that. And so there hasn't been a lot of attention paid to heart disease risk in women. And so I think the real thing that the physicians are involved with the guideline development are trying to put in front of people is the idea that every woman, once she reaches adult age, should have her risk for heart disease assessed at every doctor's visit. And the stunning thing is when they talk about risk assessment, if you look at how they have defined risk, people at risk for heart disease, over 90% of American women are at risk for heart disease because it includes things such as physical inactivity, being overweight, smoking, having high blood pressure, things that many, many women have. And so if you look at the list, almost every woman in America is at risk for heart disease. And once you realize that, it's very important to have the conversations about how you can reduce that risk.
Yeah, so what kind of risk assessment should adult women be going over with their doctors at every visit?
Well, Well, the primary risk assessment here is just to be aware of behaviors or conditions in your life that put you at risk for heart disease. It's not testing that has to be done, but it's more, are you smoking cigarettes? If you're smoking cigarettes, you're at risk for heart disease, and you need to do what you can to quit. If your diet is poor, if you're eating a high-fat diet, low in fiber, low in fruits and vegetables, that puts you at risk for heart disease in the future. And we're talking about risk that's 10 or 20, 30, even 40 years down the road. But the idea of these guidelines is if we get women when they're young and start modifying their behaviors then, by the time their risk really increases in their postmenopausal years, they've already adopted a lifestyle that's heart healthy and optimized their chances of avoiding heart disease.
Yeah. The exercise guideline, 30 minutes of moderately intense exercise every day.
Yes. You know, we all know that we don't exercise enough, but I think it's stunning how much we don't exercise enough. And in fact, if you actually want to lose weight, the recommendation is 60 to 90 minutes every day. These are guidelines that came out, again, from a national body looking at fitness and exercise, cardiovascular fitness and weight loss within the last 2 years. And the recommendations for what it actually takes to achieve heart health are pretty stunning in terms of the amount it requires. Now, the thing to remember, however, is that this doesn't mean running, 4-minute miles 30 minutes a day. It means being active, getting your heart rate up, breaking a sweat. You can climb stairs and do this. And it doesn't have to be 30 continuous minutes. Incorporate 30 minutes into your day.
Yeah. You mentioned the diet. Eat lots of fruits and vegetables, whole grains, high-fiber foods, fish at least twice a week, it says here, and limit saturated fat. And it also says limit alcohol to one drink a day or less.
Right.
Yeah. And alcohol contributes to heart? I thought it was the other way around.
Well, alcohol in excess contributes to heart disease. Alcohol is a poison to heart muscle, and heart muscle doesn't function as well when there's high alcohol levels around. But mild to moderate amounts of alcohol do seem to protect against building up cholesterol and fat in the blood vessels in the body. But for women, the amount of alcohol it takes to have that preventive effect is much less than in men. So really, one drink a day for women will give you all the benefits of alcohol without any risk. And so that's the recommended dose.
And this is one that I didn't know either. It says here that in terms of supplement, don't worry about taking supplements like vitamin E, C, beta-carotene, or folic acid. That doesn't do anything for heart disease.
Yes, this is another sort of very interesting finding coming out of studies in the last few years. Over the last decade, there's been a lot of excitement about these supplements, particularly the antioxidant vitamins like vitamin C and vitamin E, because it's known that inflammation and oxidative stress may be involved in causing heart attacks. But many large studies have now been completed looking at people randomized to taking these vitamins or not taking these vitamins and future risk of heart attack in particular, and there's no impact on reducing heart attack when people take these drugs. And so, again, we would advise a healthy diet that's rich in fruits and vegetables, which contain antioxidants, but there's no need to supplement a good diet.
Yeah. Talk about, speaking of drugs, we should be taking medications if our blood pressure or our cholesterol is out of whack.
Absolutely. And what we consider out of whack has been a moving target also. Blood pressures that we now consider treatable are much lower than they were even 5 or 10 years ago. And same with cholesterol. We're treating at lower cholesterol values, particularly the bad cholesterol, LDL. We're treating at much lower numbers now than we used to. For most women, even if your blood pressure is mildly elevated or your cholesterol is not perfect, the first line of therapy is going to be lifestyle modification, recommendations for exercise and diet, particularly low-salt diets and exercise are very effective at lowering blood pressure in women. Losing weight is very effective at lowering blood pressure and lowering cholesterol in many women. And so the first-line recommendation is still going to be modifying your lifestyle to be more heart healthy. But if you can't achieve good numbers doing that, then we're going to drugs much earlier now.
Yeah. What are the numbers for blood pressure right now?
So the The number above which blood pressure should absolutely be treated is a systolic blood pressure, or the bigger number should be less than 140. Mm-hmm. And the diastolic blood pressure, or the smaller number, should be less than 90. But if you have other risk factors like diabetes, you're a smoker, you have bad cholesterol, if you start clustering risk factors together, then we would like your blood pressure, actually the big number, to be below 120 and the small number to be below 80. And so, again, we will treat earlier if a woman presents and has multiple risk factors.
And as for cholesterol?
And for cholesterol, we focus primarily on the bad cholesterol, the LDL cholesterol. Mm-hmm. A goal total cholesterol should be less than 200, but the number that's really important is your bad cholesterol. And the optimal level for bad cholesterol is less than 100 now, which is significantly lower. Mm-hmm. Most people won't be treated if they're above or below 130. But it, again, depends on the clustering of risk factors you have. If you have multiple risks for heart disease, doctors are more aggressive in treating people to below 100 and even below 70 for that bad cholesterol number in women at very high risk.
We are talking about heart disease and strokes. In women in particular, the American Heart Association released new guidelines this week saying that nearly all American women are in danger of heart disease or stroke and should be more aggressive about lowering their risk. This means diet, exercise, don't smoke, and a number of other guidelines. We are talking about them with our guest and welcoming your thoughts and questions about this for her. 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, in Madison, 263-1890. It's the first time the guidelines have urged all women to consider aspirin for preventing strokes. But women should talk to their doctors about this. Our guest talking with us about how heart disease is the number one killer of men and women in this country and how it kills more women than men, and how maybe following these guidelines might lower those numbers. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Happy to have you with us. Hope you stay tuned. Kathleen Dunn is with you after 9 o'clock. After 9, Kathleen and her guests will discuss the condition of the Walter Reed Medical Center, which, according to a recent Washington Post expose, 5.5 years of combat have transformed it into a vile holding ground for physically and psychologically disabled veterans. So, some pretty horrible conditions, according to this report at the Walter Reed Medical Center, and Kathleen and her guests will talk about that after 9 o'clock. We're talking about how to keep a healthy heart with our guest, who is Nancy Schweitzer. She is an assistant professor of medicine at UW-Madison, the director of the Heart Failure Program at UW Hospital and Clinics, and we have many callers who want to talk to you, Dr. Schweitzer, so let me go to the phones and take our first one, Patty in Rochester. Hi, Patty. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for having this program. Mm-hmm. I appreciate it. I was just wondering how much my past history is going to come back to haunt me. I smoked for about 15 years, and I quit about 17 years ago.
So ever having smoked is worse than never having smoked, of course. But for every year that you have not smoked, your risk drops dramatically. And even within 1 to 2 years, risk of heart disease starts to go down, not quite to what it would be if you'd never smoked, but, you know, reasonably close. Mm-hmm. So having quit and having been away from cigarettes for 17 years is wonderful, and you've done a huge amount to reduce your risk. And you can't go back and change the fact that you did smoke, so it's not really worth worrying about that. What you can do now is live right now. Now, the one thing, though, is that secondhand smoke does contribute very significantly to heart disease in women. And so not only quitting smoking, but making sure that you're not exposed at all to secondhand smoke is very important to make sure you reduce your risk associated with cigarette smoke as low as you possibly can. But good for you for quitting.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. Thank you, Patty. This is going to sound like a silly question, Dr. Schweitzer, but why would secondhand smoke increase my risk for heart disease?
Well, it's not at all a silly question. Mm-hmm. So nicotine isn't the only thing in cigarettes that's bad. And in fact, we don't understand exactly why cigarettes are so bad for the heart. But there are many, many substances in cigarettes that cause the blood vessels of the body to change in very dramatic ways. And you don't have to be smoking the cigarette itself. You can just inhale the smoke from other people's cigarettes, and you start to see those changes in the blood vessels of the body. And it's very clearly established, especially in women who had, you know, for years in the middle of the last century, a lot of secondhand smoke exposure and not so much firsthand smoke exposure, that increased the risk of heart disease in them quite dramatically.
Yeah.
And smoking seems to contribute to the buildup of fatty deposits in the blood vessels, which are the cause of heart attacks.
Mm-hmm. These new guidelines also recommend the use of nicotine replacement products if needed to help smokers quit.
Absolutely. Nicotine replacement products do work. They don't always work the first time. Many smokers have to have repeated attempts to quit smoking. But with motivation and without getting discouraged, almost every smoker can quit. And there are lots of products, nicotine replacement products and other newer drugs that can really help. And there's a wonderful organization in Wisconsin to help citizens of Wisconsin quit smoking. I can't remember the name, the Center for Tobacco Research
Yes.
Initiative, I think it is, CTRI, and they're on the internet and can help people who are motivated to quit smoking find the right tools to help them, whatever works for them.
Thank you, Patty, for the call. Congratulations on quitting. Shannon in New Glarus. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Well, this brings up, boy, so many conversations to have on this, but one of the criticisms that holistically, you know, people working in the holistic field have about drug-based medicine is that drug therapy tends to focus sharply on single symptoms without necessarily following what's happening in the rest of the person's life. And what I've read is that the aspirin a day may be a good example of this because it apparently reduces certain risks but raises others. And I'm wondering how many of these studies on daily aspirin took account over a period of time of death or debility from all causes, not strictly what the aspirin is being aimed at.
Right. So, Shannon, that's a wonderful question. No therapy is all good or all bad, and any study has to look at not only the benefits but the risks. And, in fact, all of the studies of aspirin have looked not only at the reduction in heart disease but also the increase in bleeding risk. And as an example, a study published about a year ago now, which was an accumulation of all of the evidence in women about aspirin use, showed us a total 17% reduction in stroke in women who took aspirin. But that 17% consisted of a 24% reduction of strokes due to clots in the brain, but a 7% increase in strokes due to bleeding in the brain. The overall net reduction was a 17% reduction in strokes in the women who took aspirin, but some women did have strokes probably because they were taking aspirin. So you're absolutely right that you can't just look at heart disease risk going down and saying this is a great drug, and I don't think any of us are trying to do that, and that's why we're urging so strongly that you not go out and buy aspirin, but you have a conversation with your doctor, because every person's risk-benefit ratio is different. Now, Shannon brings up, I think, a really important point for women's heart health in that it's not just about your heart and your blood vessels. It's about who you are as a person. Personality clearly is related to heart disease. In women, it's been shown that women who have higher levels of anger and stress are at higher risk for heart disease. Depression is associated with heart disease. And so a heart disease risk assessment includes not only looking at your numbers for cholesterol and blood pressure, but also who you are as a person. Cigarette smoking in women is very highly correlated with depression, for example. So if there's a woman who's smoking and unable to quit, perhaps we need to pay attention to what are the circumstances in her life that are associated with that behavior and how we can help her deal with those circumstances so that she can achieve better health.
And by the way, it's the University of Wisconsin Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention, where you can get lots of information.
Right.
And there's also a toll-free Wisconsin Tobacco Quit Line, which is 1-800-QUIT-NOW. So anybody that wants some help with that. Next, we go to Victor in Milwaukee. Hi, Victor.
Good morning, Joy. Good morning to your guest. I'd like to ask your guest, what does a study include, like teenagers and elementary?
Oh, Victor, you know, please hold on. It just that siren is so loud that we can hardly hear you, and we'll get to you right away. Hold on. Jenny in Milwaukee, let's go to you next.
Hi. I wonder if anybody else watched the February 14th public television program on the hidden epidemic heart disease in America, because maybe I misheard, but I was taking notes, and one of the doctors was asked about aspirin, and his response was that I wrote down, it doesn't do any good unless you've had a heart attack. That's my first comment. I do have another one. And the second one...
Well, wait a second, okay. Jenny. Dr. Schweitzer, do you know about this program or what this doctor was talking about?
Well, so, you know, it's interesting. All of the guidelines prior to this week recommended that women only take aspirin if they have had a heart attack or have known cardiovascular disease, buildup of cholesterol and fat in the blood vessels. But this guideline that came out this week really changes that recommendation, and it's based on several studies showing stroke reduction primarily in women. And the change in these guidelines, they still recommend that if you've had a heart attack, you should probably take aspirin. But they also say that if you're over age 65 and have some concern about stroke, you should consider taking aspirin at low dose. And it's just consider, again, talk to your doctor about your risk for stroke versus your risk for other complications of aspirin therapy. But, again, the reason we're having this show is these guidelines are brand new.
Okay. Now, my other comment is, after listening to People's Pharmacy and reading the book Overdosed America, where they discuss cholesterol and LDL, the recommendation of the author in Overdosed in America and in the British journal Lancet cautioned patients and doctors to beware of lowering the LDL too far because it can cause stroke if it goes, I don't know what it was, I'm not sure, about below 120 or something, or Parkinson's disease, at least in England. They're working on that possibility. Did you hear anything about that?
Well, you know, there is this fear that we're going to go too low with LDL cholesterol, but I think that fear is in large part unfounded. If you look historically at the human race, when we were hunter-gatherer societies, the average LDL is estimated to have been about 40 or 50 in humans. And so evolutionarily, we lived with very low LDLs very happily. And in the most recent trials of treating to very low LDL levels, patients were routinely treated down to LDLs in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, and there was no increased incidence of any complicating disease such as Parkinson's or stroke in these people. In fact, this group did the best of any group. So it seems that evolutionarily, we were designed to have much, much lower LDLs than we do, probably as a result of the changes that have occurred in diet and activity over time in our society. And I think the fear of having an LDL that's too low is quite unfounded.
Thank you, Jenny, for the call. Victor in Milwaukee, let's hope that siren has passed. Hi, you're on there.
You're gone, Joy. Well, my question is, how far do your studies go back to, like, elementary and school age? Because, you know, you're seeing these health problems are not happening all of a sudden. It's just like accumulation of probably bad choices and bad habits, because you're dealing with a culture in a society of people that just eat, grab anything you eat. And, you know, it's past the elementary school age, and what it is these young kids are looking at the adults. You know, whatever an adult does, they think it's all right. So you're going to be dealing with a culture of avarice and just overeating. And I wouldn't be surprised if you're seeing strokes and heart ailments at children 8, 9, 10, 14 years old.
Right. So Victor has an excellent point that the overall heart health of everyone in America has deteriorated quite dramatically over the last 50 years, and it's affecting our children. We don't, particularly when we talk about females, women are quite protected by estrogen against aggressive cardiovascular disease. The two conditions that can overcome that protection are diabetes and cigarette smoking, which seem to negate the protective effects of estrogen that we have. However, I think, again, these guidelines in large part are focusing on younger and younger women because we have time to change our lifestyle. Mm-hmm. The focus of these guidelines isn't that your doctor is going to put you on a lot of drugs. The focus of these guidelines is, look at this, you're at risk for heart disease. What can you do to change that risk? You can lose weight. You can become more active. You can change your diet. You can stop smoking. So there are a lot of things that women have control over that don't involve taking drugs that can dramatically impact their heart disease risk. In fact, there was a study done recently out of Harvard that showed that if women achieved an ideal body weight, exercised regularly, stopped smoking, and ate a healthy, heart-healthy diet, they could reduce their risk of heart disease by 86%.
Wow.
That's no drugs.
Yeah. Not to bring it back to drugs, but I also noted in these guidelines about hormonal replacements, you just mentioned estrogen.
Right.
What about women who have gone through menopause?
Right. So going through menopause clearly increases women's risk of heart disease, and there's a dramatic rise in risk of heart attack, particularly after a menopause in women. That led to the sort of natural assumption that giving estrogen back to women would reduce that risk. Unfortunately, women are not that simple. It doesn't all seem to be estrogen, and in fact, a large study called the Women's Health Initiative showed quite conclusively that if you take women who have no known heart disease, who are healthy otherwise, and give them estrogen, that seems to increase the risk of heart disease. And so it is now recommended that estrogen not be used to prevent heart disease because it doesn't work. We know that premenopausal women are protected against heart disease, but the complexity of how that protection occurs is still more than we know how to treat. And so estrogen replacement therapy, while it can be useful for other symptoms such as menopausal symptoms, is not recommended for heart disease prevention.
Shenba in New Berlin sent us an email wondering if being a vegetarian will help reduce her risk of heart disease, or are there meats that you can eat to avoid or help your heart?
So a vegetarian diet is a very healthy diet generally. It's almost obligatorily high in fruits and vegetables and fiber and lower in fat. And most vegetarians tend to be thin and have appropriate body weight. Many people enjoy eating meat, and you do not have to avoid meat. The key thing is portion size with meat. There are many lean meats. Chicken, fish. Fish is particularly heart healthy and is actually recommended. But lean beef and lean pork also can be part of a healthy diet. But the key is that on your plate, less than a third of your plate should be the meat, and two-thirds of your plate should be vegetables and grains and fruits. And I think the typical American plate tends to be more than half meat, and that's where we fall down.
We're talking with Dr. Nancy Schweitzer. She's an assistant professor of medicine and at UW-Madison and director of the Heart Failure Program at UW Hospital and Clinics in Madison. We're talking about new guidelines issued this week from the American Heart Association for Women and Heart Health. The guidelines saying because nearly all American women are in danger of heart disease or stroke, they should be more aggressive in lowering their risk. In general, the guidelines aim at getting women and doctors to focus on the long-term risk of high blood pressure, smoking, lack of exercise, or being overweight. And we are discussing these new guidelines and what you can do to reduce your risk of heart disease or stroke. 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Good to have you with us. Hope you stay tuned. Kathleen Dunn with you after 9 o'clock, talking with a guest about the condition of the Walter Reed Medical Center, which is treating our veterans. doesn't sound too good, according to a Washington Post expose. We'll hear more about that after 9 o'clock. We're talking about women and heart disease and risk of stroke and new guidelines set forth by the American Heart Association that advise things like quit smoking if you do, daily exercise, eat less fat. The new guidelines also say that vitamins C and E, beta-carotene and folic acid, those supplements really aren't any good for preventing heart disease. We're welcoming your thoughts and questions about these new guidelines for our guest and any questions you have about reducing your risk of heart disease or stroke. Maggie in Madison, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I wanted to, first of all, respect the physician talking today because she's not putting the aspirin at the number one reduce for helping your body as far as reducing heart disease. Although I do want to ask the question, as far as supplements really not putting much into reducing the risk, with fruits and vegetables today, they are so depleted from the soil, and, I mean, even the food depletion that it is today 50 years ago, how are we as Americans supposed to be getting the amount of nutrients required by the USDA when that is the case? I mean, our stomachs aren't big enough to get the amount of fruits and vegetables, so therefore finding a supplement that is regulated to pharmaceutical grade, which guarantees breakdown in the body, why is that not stressed more, I guess, is my question.
Well, I think that, you know, most fruits and vegetables, quality aside, do contain plenty of nutrients. If you're concerned about the food quality, buying organic, locally grown fruits and vegetables is a way to maximize the nutritional value. And it's very clear that the average American can get all of the nutrients they need on a daily basis from fruits and vegetables. Problems with our agricultural production aside.
Thank you, Maggie. Cindy in Sun Prairie. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello. I come from a family that is very long-lived. They don't tend to have heart attacks, but they do tend to have higher cholesterol levels. And I was wondering if that's a genetic factor. The second thing I was wondering is the problems with cholesterol-lowering drugs. Causing other systems to have problems, such as muscle weakness or breakdown.
Okay, so genetics do play a big role in cholesterol levels. There are well-known genetic abnormalities where very high cholesterol or very low cholesterol does travel in a family. And again, cholesterol is complex. There's bad cholesterol and good cholesterol, and many families that have very high cholesterol levels have very high good cholesterol levels that's protective against heart disease, and those families seem to have a very strong tendency for long life. So knowing the specific numbers within the cholesterol panel is very important. In terms of cholesterol-lowering drugs and side effects, this has been an area of great concern. Millions and millions of Americans are treated with cholesterol-lowering drugs, and although it's clear there are side effects, they occur in a very, very small number of people. These drugs are considered generally extremely safe, but not completely safe, and they do require monitoring. So if you are on a cholesterol-lowering drug, your doctor should be monitoring you for side effects. But the vast majority of patients have no problems with muscle complications or liver complications with these medications.
Thank you very much, Cindy. Diane in Madison is with us now. Hi, Diane.
Hi. I have a question for your guest. Unfortunately, 5 years ago, I developed diabetes, and I've lost some weight. And then, unfortunately, I was put on Coumadin. It's a blood thinner.
Mm-hmm.
And I am supposed to, and I don't like meat that much, and I'm supposed to stay away from the leafy green vegetables that I love so much, the salads and such. And I'm wondering, what can I substitute for salads and the leafy green vegetables, grape juice, and things that I really enjoy.
Because that interacts with the Coumadin effect of blood thinning?
Mm-hmm. Yes,
yeah.
It will.
Right, so yeah, I'm going to go out on a limb here because this is a pet peeve of mine. Eating leafy green vegetables increases the body's ability to manufacture substances that makes the blood able to clot. And so if you eat a lot of leafy green vegetables, you need more Coumadin to achieve the desired blood level.
Mm-hmm. But what I tell my patients is you don't have to avoid those things. If you avoid them completely, you need very, very low doses of Coumadin to achieve your target blood level. If you eat leafy green vegetables, you need a higher dose of Coumadin, but you can still achieve your target blood level. The key thing is to eat the same amount every day. So if you want to incorporate leafy green vegetables into your diet, talk to your doctor about it and say, I want to incorporate this. I know my Coumadin dose is going to have to go up, but I'll do it every day. I'll eat these things every day and be healthy doing it. And I think most doctors would be willing to work with you as long as you do it with their knowledge so that you can be monitored while you're changing your diet because your Coumadin dose will change.
Okay. Also, I have another question.
Mm-hmm.
Does meat affect the Coumadin level at all?
Typically not, no.
Yeah, I'm curious, Diane. My mother was on Coumadin. She's since passed away, but she had a stroke and was put on Coumadin to thin her blood because they believed it was a clot in her carotid mm-hmm. artery that caused the stroke. But you're put on Coumadin for diabetes?
Actually, what happened was the doctor noticed something in me, and I thought it was from another medication I was taking. And he did an EKG, and he said he didn't like the way it looked. So he put me on Valpamil, and I had to take that for 5 days, which I did, and he wanted me to come back and have it checked again. And I saw a cardiologist.
Yeah.
And
all right, that I understand. It was based on some other things, not the diabetes.
No.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Diane, for the call. Laura in Cedarburg is next. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I was calling to find out, I've heard that there is a relationship between dental health and heart disease, and my dad had a condition where he had some dental work done. He had already had heart disease, and about a week later, he died. And, of course, I don't know if that's related, but I've heard the relationship exists.
Right. Probably in your dad's case, it was not related. However, the relationship is that having poor dental health, probably in your younger years, raises levels in inflammatory substances in the body that are thought perhaps to be involved in making the arteries build up fatty plaques that can cause future heart attacks. But we're talking probably about a risk cascade that extends over decades here. So having poor teeth as a child and a young adult may cause heart attacks when you're 40, 50, 60 years old. And that is not conclusively known. Those are hard studies to do when you're talking about a risk that you have to wait decades to see the effect of. So at this point, it's mostly a theory. It's known that people who have good dental health have lower risk for heart attacks.
We have an open line for you if you have a question about reducing your risk of heart disease. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison 263-1890. We are discussing new guidelines out this week from the American Heart Association for Women's Heart Health. The guidelines saying that 90%, nearly all American women, are in danger of heart disease or stroke and should be more aggressive about lowering their risks. The guidelines talk about diet and exercise and quitting smoking and a number of other things, including asking your doctor about daily aspirin use as one possibility. Let's go back to the phones and go to June Marie in St. Paul. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, I have arthritis and the inflammation. Does that affect your heart in any way?
Yeah, that's a wonderful question. Inflammation is clearly related in to building up blockages in arteries and heart attacks, but it's unknown if treating that inflammation can prevent the heart attacks. And clearly people who have a lot of inflammation in the body, usually not local inflammation like arthritis in one joint, but inflammation that is causing substances that circulate through the whole body, those people do have increased risk of heart attacks. People, with, for example, with rheumatoid arthritis as opposed to osteoarthritis do have increased risk of heart attack. And again, it's a risk factor. It doesn't mean you will have a heart attack, but you should talk to your doctor, again, about how to reduce your risk as much as you can.
Dr. Schweitzer, just before the we started this program, we heard a story in our state newscast that was about a 39-year-old Madison woman who happens to be a physician. Mm-hmm. She's a jogger, and she eats a good diet and seemed to be relatively healthy. And she has not one but two heart attacks. Mm-hmm. In part, I think she didn't think she had a heart attack. She was having a heart attack. Is that part of the problem here? Is that women don't believe they're having heart attacks when they're having heart attacks?
Yeah, so that's a big problem. And part of it is that, you know, if everyone listening closed their eyes and pictures someone having a heart attack, I would mm-hmm. bet that most of them picture a gray-haired man hunched over clutching his chest. Mm-hmm. We don't think of women when we think of heart attacks, and it was for many years thought to be a man's disease. But it's clearly also a woman's disease. Unfortunately, most of the research that has been done in men, and the disease in women is unquestionably different than it is in men. Women have, although the most common symptom of a heart attack in a woman is chest discomfort, mm-hmm. Often described as pressure or squeezing or tightness or just an uncomfortable feeling, women are more likely to have unusual symptoms of a heart attack, such as nausea, vomiting. The woman described that she just felt very nauseated and was lying down because of that when she was having her heart attack. Pain in other areas, the jaw, the arms, the back, is much more common in women. Generally, when there's a problem in the arteries of the heart, the pain will occur with exertion and be relieved by rest. But when a heart attack begins suddenly, as it sounds like this woman's did, it can just come out of the blue. And women tend, especially if you're 39 years old, I think it's pretty reasonable to think that it's something else going on. But if it's severe pain, it's not going away. There are other symptoms to go with it, such as sweating or shortness of breath, or this woman noticed that her pulse was very low. It's always wise to seek attention. And if you're concerned that you might be having a heart attack or a stroke, call 911. Don't wait to get a ride somewhere mm-hmm. because time matters. In both heart attacks and strokes, every minute that passes can lead to death of a tissue, the heart or the brain, that is not easily regenerated. So you want to get help as fast as you can. And then if it's not a heart attack, great. You did what you could to make sure you preserved a very important organ.
Yeah. And I'm wondering if this is part of the reason why more women die of heart attacks or heart disease than men do.
Yeah, the reason is it's very complex. One of the reasons, far fewer women used to die mm-hmm. Than men. And in the mid-80s, women passed men because men's rates of death from heart disease have been going down steadily for about two decades, almost three decades now. Women's risk has not been going down. It has been staying up. And in part, that's because more women have been smoking. And women have lower rates of physical activity, higher rates of obesity than men. And diabetes in particular, which is growing in prevalence, is a very strong risk factor for women. So it's complex why women's risk of heart disease has been going up and why women's death risk. But there's no question that failure to recognize symptoms being treated later, when women present, they tend to present with much more complex and severe disease. They often have more coexisting diseases because they're older when they present. Men tend to present in their 50s with their first symptoms of heart disease. Women tend to present in their 60s after they've gone through menopause.
Next, we go to Judith in Milwaukee. Hi, Judith.
Hello. My question is there research being done for people like me who have observed all the guidelines, were not overweight, don't smoke, never did, was vegetarian most of my life, still end up with coronary artery disease?
Mm-hmm.
Is there research being done, and also what direction would you point a person like me to for better health?
Right. Well, so, there are things you can control, which it sounds like you've done, your diet, your exercise, and your lifestyle. And then there are things you can't control, which are primarily genetic. And unfortunately, we are all, in many respects, victims of the genes we were born with. There's, of course, a lot of research going on looking at ways to reduce disease risk further. I would point you toward a good preventive cardiology clinic because often sophisticated cholesterol testing can be done that looks beyond just LDL and HDL, the good and bad cholesterols, but looks at particle size of the cholesterols in your body and can do a more extensive risk factor modification in someone such as yourself who's clearly at high risk without question. We have here at the University of Wisconsin a second opinion line when we can hook you up with one of our doctors. We have an excellent preventive cardiology program here. Can I give the number, Joy,
sure,
for this?
Sure.
So our second opinion hotline here at the University of Wisconsin in cardiology is 1-800-438-3102. In Madison, you can call 263-7092, and we can usually get you in within 48 hours to see a cardiologist who can give you a second opinion about what might be done.
Thank you very much, Judith, and good luck to you. Lisa in Lake Geneva, hi, you're on the air.
Hello. This is a great show, but I was wondering about fish oil. I keep hearing a lot of people taking fish oil supplements or flaxseed supplements, and is this recommended or is this study deep enough to...
Yes, it's actually in there. Go ahead, Doctor.
So fish oil is actually a recommended thing. It tends to be very effective at increasing good cholesterol. Generally, fish oil is not recommended if you don't have a known heart disease, though. This is an intervention we typically say for people who are at very high risk. If you either have known heart disease or you have many risk factors that are significant, such as diabetes and high blood pressure. If you're otherwise healthy, we would probably not recommend taking fish oil at this point, but rather focusing on other heart-healthy things. But, for example, the previous caller, Judith, who's done all the right things and still has coronary artery disease, is probably someone who could consider fish oil as an additive to her regimen.
Yeah, so consider the fish oil supplements if you already have heart disease, but it does say with diet consider eating fish at least twice a week.
Right. There's a lot of ways, you know, what fish oil is omega-3 fatty acids, which we know tend to enhance heart health. And there are a lot of ways to get omega-3 fatty acids naturally in your diet. Fish is the best example, but there are many other foods that do have omega-3 in them. And, you know, you can even buy eggs now where the chickens are fed high omega-3 diets, so they're eggs have omega-3s in them, so there are ways to get it in your diet without taking the fish oil capsules.
Tom in Elm Grove, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. My question is, I have a high LDL number, but I also have a very high HDL number, and when I look on the Heart Association's website, it says if it's below 3.5, you are optimum. But my wife says, no, you're not. And my doctor says, maybe you need some medication.
Well, what's optimum in less than a minute? I'm sorry, Dr. Schweitzer.
That's okay. Mm-hmm. What he's talking about is his ratio of LDL to HDL.
Mm-hmm.
And that ratio, when it's less than 4, is optimum, and that's good. But we do know that having a high LDL, particularly in men, in and of itself does carry risk. And I think I would consider doing things to try and reduce that, even with the high HDL, which will be protective.
Well, we had a lot of interest in this program, and I do appreciate your time. Thank you so very much.
My pleasure. Thank you, Joy.
Yeah, Nancy Schweitzer is an assistant professor of medicine and director of the Heart Failure Program at the University of Wisconsin Hospitals and Clinic in Madison. And we thank her very much for talking with us about these new guidelines issued this week from the American Heart Association. Thanks to Rita Thomas and Karen Prager and Cheryl Gasser for producing this program. Thank you for listening and for calling in. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.